You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Say hello, Flavio. It's time for another Flat Chat. The latest edition of GP Racing Magazine is on the newsstands as we preview the British Grand Prix, because it's a British magazine. We can preview it if we like. And what a preview package it is. But as is often the case with the stately progress of monthly magazine production cycles, stuff happens in between us hitting print and the magazine landing on the shelves. In this case, utterly absurd rumours of Flavio Briatore returning to a senior role in F1 becoming utterly absurd fact. You just couldn't make it up. Let's bring on the guests. First up, someone who definitely doesn't make things up, and certainly not on his loo day, which this is. He's not enjoying a town close to Penzance, also called Loo. This is L-I-E-U. It's Alex Kalinorkas.
Hello, Clodders. Yes, yeah. not in Penzance, but no. You say that the magazine's on newsstands. I have a copy of it here for the first time as we're doing recording, which I very unhelpfully waved at you as you were reading your scripted introduction very well. Had I been doing the reverse, I would have been completely put off. So I was like, Alex, what are you doing? Put that down. There we go. Anyways, it's nice to have a copy of the magazine with us as we do this.
As you know, I'm used to performing live in front of an utterly unregulated audience at the Autosport Show. Not anymore now that it's owned by a different company, of course. I'm stood down from that. But, you know, you have all sorts of people pulling faces at you while you're trying to perform to that lot, whether it's whether you're reading it or whether you're doing it off, whether you're going off on a tandem, as Steve Soper once said. All you have to do is you can think you're being as funny as anything, and then your eyes are light on the person who's there going, I paid 20 quid for this and 10 quid parking. Do something funny. Be better. Anyway.
Yeah, but everybody likes your I'm a terrible tosser line when you're throwing them free gifts, though, don't they, Goddess?
Do you know, there had to be a health and safety audit about whether it was safe to throw Ferrari merchandise from the stage. Anyway, second guest, live from New York, enjoying life in the Big Apple, as Kajagoogoo sang. Another reference that will go straight over Alex's head. It's Mark Gallagher.
Very pleased to join you. I feel very sorry for you, Alex, that we have intruded into your loo day when you're should be having a well deserved break from work routine. But anyway, pleasure to have the chance to chat to you and hear from New York. You've always wanted to say the words live from New York, haven't you, Cotters?
Very much so. And in actual fact, you know, our new owners, I say new, they're owners about a year now, are actually based in New York. That's where the head office is, on Madison Avenue. And when I say Madison Avenue, I, of course, don't refer to the Australian pop duo who had a 1999 hit with Don't Call Me Baby, lady of which now apparently a recluse, a little bit like her out of ABBA. Anyway, enough of this madness. Treading neatly around the legal niceties, Flav, what about him? A fascinating character who has been at the heart of many pivotal moments in Formula One, from Michael Schumacher's move to Benetton to the disgraceful events of the 2008 Singapore Grand Prix. I will not describe brokering the MSC Cruises sponsorship deal as a pivotal moment. I believe he also owns a restaurant in Baku, also not pivotal. I mean, Mark, presumably you've been to Baku. Have you ever been to Flavio's restaurant there?
I haven't been to Flavio's restaurant in Baku, but I have been to one of his billionaire nightclubs, which I think was in Sardinia, if I recall correctly. And that was a pretty harrowing experience. It was one of those places you go in, have a look and remind yourself never to become a billionaire and then quickly leave, just full of incredibly shallow people. But anyway, but of course, one of the joys of, I suppose, being a Jordan from 91 through to 2004 was that it kind of very much paralleled, you know, Flavio's, you know, time in Formula One, certainly his early years at Benetton. And then, you know, he became one of the big four team bosses. And then, of course, when I left Jordan, you know, he was just on the point of, you know, seeing a couple of championships come Fernando's way at Renault. And as you say, there was then the dreaded Singapore crash gate, which has come to kind of very much cast a shadow over anything that he had achieved before that. Having said all of that, I mean, I read the news last week just with a degree of incredulity, but then on the other hand thinking, well, if anyone was going to stage some kind of a comeback, it would be Flavio, because he loves Formula One. He's been a very successful businessman. He's what you might call a heavy hitter, even if some people don't like the way that he operates or what they've heard about the way he operates, because let's face it, not many people who write about Flavio have ever actually done or broadcast about Flavio have ever actually done any business with him. And he's successful for a good reason. You know, he is very good at deal making. Also last night when I got here to New York, you know, I was in a bar talking to a couple of people about Formula One, and they asked me about Flavio, and then we got onto the subject of aging leaders, you know, because here in America at the moment we're 24 hours away from Joe Biden and Donald Trump debating, you know, the future of the presidency of the United States. And I was saying to them that it seemed highly unlikely at the beginning of this year that two of the biggest stories in Formula One would revolve around 76-year-old Eddie Jordan and 74-year-old Flavio Briatore, you know, coming back into the sport, you know, combined 150 years between them in terms of life experience and, you know, all their collective, intrigue of their careers. But I think that actually then cuts to the chase about the Flavio thing, which is that, as you and I have talked about before, Connors, one of the things about the new era of team principals in Formula One is that a lot of them come from a technical background. And I think the role of team principal has been diluted to quite a significant extent over the years, because we no longer have team principals who own the teams. We have team principals who are contracted employees, as I say, many of them with a technical background, not a business background. At the weekend in Spain, when I spoke to people about Flavio coming back in, I was very struck by one person who said to me, it's really interesting because he has got power. And I said, what do you mean by power? And they said, well, he doesn't need to do this. You know, he's a very successful, very wealthy man. He's on another level, and he can sit down with Luca de Meo from Renault and they can talk about kind of big picture business strategy. Where's it all going? You know, he obviously knows F1 extremely well. Again, whatever people may think about his principles or otherwise. The reality is he knows the sport very well. He's got gravitas. People will take him seriously. People dealing with him will take him seriously. And although he doesn't represent the future, he probably represents a moment in time when Luca de Meo needs someone to give him big answers to the questions of what do I have to do to turn Alpine around, because it's not going anywhere fast, literally. I mean, it's as again, we've talked about Alpine, and I've written about Alpine in my column, you know, many times over the years. It's a team that has just thrashed around, with, particularly on the leadership front. There have been chopping and changing going on. They're trying to find what the formula is to bring Enstone to the front in Formula One, and it's not there. And it may be that Flavio takes a look inside the team and goes back to Luca de Meo and says, actually, the problem is with you, because you're not putting enough money in, and you're not, you know, you're not giving people enough time to deliver. And that is the difference with, I think, with Flavio. He can not only go toe to toe with anybody in F1, he'll happily go toe to toe with Luca de Meo if he has to, and say, listen, you need to allocate a lot more resource. Stop, you know, if you want to have the best team in Formula One, stop trying to also have teams in sports car racing and teams in other championships, and, you know, spreading yourself too thinly for a brand that still only sells a handful of cars. You know, if you're going to do Formula One, do it properly, or don't do it at all. And I think that's much more likely to be the benefit of having someone like Flavio around. It's such an interesting development. It could really go places, as, you know, if he applies all his knowledge and expertise, it could be a game changing moment. It could equally just be another catastrophic chapter in Luca de Meo's quest for, you know, glory for Alpine. And I just hope, for the sake of all the employees of the team in Enstone, that it's the former, that it somehow leads to an upping of the ante in terms of Renault's commitment to Formula One, rather than seeing it diluted further, or indeed the worst possible outcome, which is that De Meo turns around in a few years' time and decides, that's it, I'm out of here.
Alex, obviously you weren't working in Formula One at the time of Crashgate, in perhaps not so short trousers, but it was something that left a bit of an indelible scar on the Formula One landscape. And actually, you could kind of describe it as the turd that won't flush down, because here we are again talking about it 16 years later, with Felipe Massa still attempting to follow some sort of action of legal recourse to get the result of the World Championship annulled.
Yeah, I was doing my A-levels that year, 2008. I was doing my AS-levels as the following year, A-levels, 2009. Anyway, yeah, I think there's two ways of looking at this, and it's very interesting you bring up the Felipe Massa thing, Codders, because it's just interesting to think about. You know, F1 really don't want that talked about at all, but here we go. There's, you know, one of the key people in that story is now front and center, and I think there's two things to really think about with this development. And the first bit of it is that, you know, for all of the sort of technical skullduggery, the idea that, you know, this is the Piranha Club, you do what you have to do to win, that's always been a part of Formula One. But I think the sporting integrity really is supposed to be sacrosanct. Otherwise, it is just scripted drive to survive. That's you know, it's preordained. It's not supposed to be like that. So Crashgate was really horrible. Because the idea of, one, a driver being told to crash on purpose and endanger themselves is nasty enough, but then, you know, to add in the fact that you're trying to artificially to cheat, if effectively, you know, that's just not on. So to have someone involved in that back, I know the lifetime ban was overturned, things like that, complicated legal matters. You just don't want that. You things are supposed to be separate. But I'm wondering, overall, especially in the new era now, how many people really care? I like to think your discerning GP racing reader would care, but do Drive to Survive fans, you know, this whole this great audience that we're being told, you know, is what everybody's working towards. Do they care that much, that new audience that aren't buying all the tickets at Silverstone? You know, it's not as narrowed on as people think. But if they don't care, this is the other bit of it that alarms me. It just shows to me that, you know, because, you know, he's welcome back. The FIA are fine with it. Formula One are fine with it. It just shows you that standards don't matter. And it's sort of, I think there's parallels. You can tell I've been listening to a lot of the news agents podcast and that we've got an election on in the UK. I think there's real parallels between, you know, shoddy politicians getting away with it and people just going, oh, okay, I guess that's how it is then. With someone like Flavio, considering what happened around Crashgate, coming back. That's one thing. So, I mean, I've, you can probably tell from my point of view, I think from that point of view, I don't think he should be back, but he is. And the other thing I think that, well, what I've thought about it from this development of this story is, I agree with Mark. I think this is really good for Alpine. I think we've got a team that was floundering. You know, what, Renault came back in 2016, went nowhere, signed all those drivers. Fernando Alonso walked out on the project. Alpine, who's heard of that? You know, the Le Mans triumph, but your person, you know, your win on Sunday, buy on Monday thing, who's buying an Alpine? It wasn't working. And now, you know, and then we got into 2024 when it's gone even worse. The car's terrible at the start of the year. Yes, okay, they have worked very hard and it is improving. But you had Bruno Famin going, oh, we're just going to wait and see what happens with the drivers, with the driver market. Or, oh, I don't, you know, I'm not interested in the past. I'm only interested in, you know, making the car faster. Certain amount of hard F1 logic about that. But immediately Briatore's back. There's an offer made to Carlos Sainz. He's suddenly thinking, oh, it's not just Audi and Williams that I've got to choose between. Alpine, which scored 2 points in, you know, sorry, two, a double points finish in the Spanish Grand Prix. Williams didn't do that. Hang on a minute. They might be going customer engines in the future. If they align themselves with the best one and they've got a car that's better than the Williams, suddenly that makes my choice much more complicated. And I think that shows you what Briatore can do. It's a key thing that he's been brought in to do is to make things happen, and he's already seemingly doing that with, you know, getting on the front foot when it comes to drivers as Famin didn't want it. There's sort of this suggestion that it's at least a two-year project. Does that suggest Renault is in it for the long haul? The sale rumours won't go away. Could Flavio end up owning the team? Who knows? It could be a precursor to that. So yeah, two ways of looking at it. But I think what really summed up Flavio being back in the paddock this weekend was that while I was sat in the media centre, I've been to that Barcelona media centre countless times, but I was right up the far end by the FIA offices, which is actually quite close to the podium. And at various points, you could see people gathering there, all the support races, obviously the Grand Prix after Max Verstappen beat Lando Norris. And after the F1 Academy race that Abby Pulling had won, or I actually think my specific memory is when she finished second behind Chloe Chambers in race two, was that all of the important people who wanted to get themselves on the cameras, including Flavio Briatore, were right at the front of Parc Fermé. He was right there. He was with Luca Di Meo. And where was Bruno Famin? Way back, like 20, 30 metres back, anonymously on his phone, just looking a bit uncomfortable. And I think that really sums it up, that Flavio's gone, no, I'm here now. I might just be an executive advisor or whatever his title is, but I'm going to make sure I'm the, you know, I'm front and centre of the whole thing. So, yeah, I don't like it, but it's certainly something interesting that's happened and potentially could go places.
Yeah. In the words of the German finance minister, you don't like it, but you've got to put up with it.
Quite.
It's funny you mentioned Bruno Famin and the kind of body language around that whole thing with, you know, Flavio walking alongside Di Meo, for all the world, like some aging gunslinger who's been brought back into town, you know, to sort things out. And it reminded me of an infamous comment, you know, from Bernie Eccleston many years ago, when a team sent some, you know, team principal to a meeting with Bernie, and Bernie said, don't send a boy to do a man's job. You know, I want to deal with people at the top. I don't want to deal with people who are just minions. And that's the thing. Flavio's not going to be anyone's minion. And I mean, it is an extraordinary turn of events. I think that, you know, for the benefit of some of the listeners who weren't around at the time of Crashgate, you know, all that anyone remembers is that you know, Nelson Piquet Jr. was asked to crash the car, and you know, ultimately led to a victory, an apparently surprise victory for Fernando Alonso. The background to all of that was that Flavio felt under massive pressure from Renault to get some success going. And he and Pat Simmons, and obviously I'm conscious of the fact that Pat was involved in that whole Crashgate controversy as well. And of course, he's a fellow columnist for the magazine. You know, Pat and Flavio were involved in them, what then became this pivotal scandal in Formula One's history. And to your point, Alex, you're absolutely right. You know, that principles and the way in which you conduct business are extremely important. And I think one of the hallmarks of Liberty's management of Formula One is a far greater degree of transparency and better ethics. And, you know, they like to do things properly, and they definitely like to be seen to do things properly. So you know, Flavio coming back in seems to fly in the face of that. But it's also then really interesting to take a step back and say, so, you know, you've got Flavio and Crashgate against a backdrop of Renault putting massive pressure on the team to find success. And the cost of Crashgate was a disqualification for Renault. They lost their title sponsor, ING. They lost a major secondary sponsor, a Spanish company, Mutual Magdalena. There was, you know, lower lifetime bans for Flavio and Pat. They then went to the French courts to get that overturned. And one of the things that gets forgotten about is that the FIA reached a settlement with them to allow them back into Formula One. And of course, Pat was straight back in with, you know, as an advisor to Virgin, to Manor, and of course has had a stellar career since in Formula One, including working with Liberty on all of the future direction of Formula One. So there's a lot behind this story aside from just the immediate headline, but I would love to have been a fly on the wall of a meeting between Di Meo and Briatore, just shooting the breeze, saying, what are we trying to do here? What are we trying to achieve? And Di Meo perhaps fessing up to the fact that he's tried a number of things. He's had people who have been, you know, friends of his, like David Brivio, you know, put into the team to try and help turn things around. He's, you know, tried a number of different formula to get Enstone pointed in the right direction, but it's just not quite happening. And realizing, I need help here. So it's going to be really, it's going to be a very interesting new chapter. And, you know, we'll be watching this with eagle eyes to see the dynamics of the whole thing. You know, are we going to see Flavio standing in the garage? Is he going to turn up on the pit wall? You know, is he, you know, what are we going to, how's it all going to manifest itself? And of course, the other thing is that he, you know, has been managing Fernando Alonso. And of course, Fernando came into Alpine and then left. And, you know, so you suspect that behind the scenes, Flavio has known rather a lot about what's been going on within that team and the dynamic within it for some period of time. And the Netflix Drive to Survive people must be just rubbing their hands in glee. They've got this, you know, aging Lothario Formula One star has come back into the frame. And it's going to be another interesting storyline for the rest of this year.
They'll have been all over that scene with Flav up front and Bruno Famin lost and not looking like he knows what he wants to do. That's very, yeah. That's absolutely, you know, that's meat and potatoes to Netflix, isn't it? I mean, yeah, I suppose, you know, one of my reservations about Flavio is his lack of understanding about technical matters. I know there are people who can advise him, but certainly one of the reasons that Renault's engines have been problematic for the past couple of decades now is that Flav kind of took the 2006 engine freeze at face value and radically downsized the headcount at Viri, where the engines are made. And apart from some clever mapping that was done on a low budget to suit the Red Bull engine partnership, that set them on the back foot all the way into the hybrid era and has been a problem ever since. So it kind of is tricky, isn't it?
I think what's interesting with that is the fact that suddenly there's this consideration that actually we might not even do our own Formula One engines. I mean, in a way, you think, so what's the point then? And the sale suggestion gets more credence. But Renault have just announced this massive deal with Geely. Sorry, my pronunciation is appalling. To build, you know, the Chinese company building a road car engine. So potentially, there could be other expertise coming. But I think there's sort of the other element that I think need to get in with this, and I think this speaks to your point, Mark, is that there's this suggestion quite consistently over the years that not only have mistakes been made, like you say, Cotters, with the downsizing the engine department, but that the Renault corporate structure gets involved too much with the race team, that it's just constant, what's going on. And perhaps now, with Briatore being back, that he can, if that is the real issue, he can tell that to back off, to stop, and maybe it will have a positive impact.
This is a brilliant point you just made, Alex. Absolutely pivotal point. One of the characteristics, one of the hallmarks of the Briatore era at Renault, at Enstone, was that he ran it as his own fiefdom. And he essentially said to Renault, and back then it was, you know, towards the end of his tenure, it was Carlos Ghosn, he of the musical case Escape from Japan. And if you don't know what that's about, go and Google it. So Carlos Ghosn was CEO there, but Flavio Briatore ran that very much as his personal fiefdom. So he got a budget from Renault. He then went and did all his sponsorship deals. You know, initially, of course, he was brought in by the Benetton family itself. And then, of course, he did the deal with Mile 7, and he did all the other deals, Korean Air and other major sponsors there. So he was running it very much as a separate enterprise, which is absolutely essential for a car manufacturer. It's one of the reasons why Mercedes-Benz at Brackley runs so well. You know, it's not run by Daimler-Benz. It's owned by Jim Ratcliffe and Toto Wolff and Daimler-Benz in equal partnership. You know, and again, I think one of the benefits for Red Bull Racing is that Christian and the team are very much, that's run as a completely separate business. They have, you know, complete autonomy. And I do think this is the problem that Renault have. Actually, I've always believed that, this is the problem that Renault have had in recent times. I've always believed that one of the problems of them having the engine facility in Viry is that there's almost this temptation to see the team as being split between Paris and Enstone, you know, between Viry and Enstone. And in reality, Enstone is the team. Paris just has to provide them with the most powerful engines they can possibly give them. I spoke recently to an engineer who's been with Renault. He's no longer with them now, but I talked to an engine engineer, been with Renault, and he said, you know, what Viry are very good at doing is building, you know, quite sophisticated, but fundamentally compliant Formula One engines. They're never leading edge. They're never the most powerful, but you know, they tick the box. And whether it was when they were supplying engines to Red Bull and Red Bull won 4 world championships or whatever, you know, Renault have always produced a pretty good, you know, consistent engine, but never class leading. And that's not the ethos. And this comes from, you know, again, this just slight corporate mentality of being maybe a little bit conservative in the way the thing is operated. And, you know, you've got to take the gloves off. You've got, I'm mixing all my metaphors now. You've got to take your gloves off and go for it. So it'll be really interesting to see whether Flavio can say to Luca Di Meo, stop trying to run the Formula One team as some subsidiary or division of Alpine Car Company with people like Laurent Rossi going in to try and sort of that. He knew nothing about Formula One, and that was demonstrated during his tenure. The team has got to be run by racers. Just give them the budget, let them get on with the job, and have a big meeting once a year to say, how did you do? And tell them to, you know, just let them get on with it. And I think that's going to be possibly the most important conversation above and beyond anything on the technical front. And going back to your point, Cotters, you know, I agree with you. You know, Flavio Briatore is not a technical guy. And that doesn't matter. You know, Formula One teams are packed full of smart technical people who can do amazing things. The thing that you fundamentally need is a business leader who can lead the business, who can structure it, recruit the best talent, headhunt the best people, and then get them to you know, unlock their ambitions. You know, listen, guys, go, guys and girls, go for it. You know, let's be the, let's create a framework within which you can all excel. Any more than Christian Horner is not a technical person, you know, but the reality is that as a leader, you've got a different set of, you've got a different set of tasks in front of you. And I think that's, again, where Flavio can perhaps maybe give a little bit of direction. It's got to be really fascinating to watch.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
He's also very, well, he was very influential as kind of an alpha male figure among the team principals. So it'd be interesting to see whether he has any interaction with the new breed, some of them obviously still around. I heard a fantastic story, and it was from one of the people on the plane. So this is not gossip. It was told to me by one of the people present that basically the team principals were flying to some race on a couple of private jets. Flav had his, a bunch of the others were in this other jet, which went technical. So Flav said, to indicate that some of them could come aboard, aboard his jet. So, you know, on they filed, your Christian Horners, your Ron Dennis's, whatnot. They had to get, you know, they found a special thing so that Sir Frank Williams could be brought onto it. And then Colin Collis, who was running the Spiker team or whatever it was called then, younger listeners or fans who haven't been around for such a long time may not know of Colin Collis, but he was very much Bernie's eyes and ears on the factory floor back in the day, a Romanian former dentist, a short and rather stout man who on this day was wearing a very tight-fitting green jumper. And as he made his way up the jetway, Flav apparently went, "Hey, Froggy, not you." So Collis had to go, basically arrive late and fly commercial. I just love that. "Yeah, not you, Froggy." Anyhow, so hopefully we've punctured some of the angst regarding Flavio Briatore with that anecdote. Let's bring the blood pressure down by looking elsewhere in the latest issue. British Grand Prix preview, as I said, we've put together a big package of what our paymasters like to call content. Lewis Hamilton has won the race itself 8 times, so often that I actually have to double check that stat on Forex every time I write it, because it just seems absolutely ridiculous. We wondered if we could drill down into some of the lesser told stories around some of his finest performances at Silverstone and come up with greatest hits. And quite a few of those wins obviously came from making use of the fastest car in the day, especially in the hybrid era. But there are times when Lewis has had to put up a fight, which is why we chose his races in the 2006 British Grand Prix support card as part of that package. Frederic Vasseur, who was running him in ART at that point, agreed and spoke to us about that. Perhaps the most intriguing was the role of GP Racing's principal photographer, Stephen T, and what he did in 2008. Alex, you know, as someone who keeps a close eye on tyres, what did you make of this piece of sort of old tech gimcrackery to do with taking pictures of tyres on the pit wall as they came past?
I'll have you know, Connors, that Autosport Grand Prix editors must keep abreast the tyres at all times. And honestly, that it makes a difference to F1 races way more often than anybody ever thinks is what the tyres are doing and what the drivers can do with them. But anyway, my main takeaway, actually, it's really interesting because the story that Connors is referring to actually goes back to Hamilton winning the 2008 Monaco Grand Prix, which was a wet and dry race. You spoke to Paddy Lowe for this piece, Connors, who was obviously there heading up McLaren's engineering department at the time, sort of track engineering department at the time. And basically the fallout of Hamilton losing the 2007 world title with his tyres going down to the canvas and the team not being aware of that. These are the days before you got the sensors measuring all everything to do with the tyres. It was basically the team going, oh, right, well, we can't let that happen again in other sort of wet to dry races. So Paddy Lowe in his role is up and down the pit lane, checking out other people's tyres during the race. And he realises that Lewis is on the intermediates. He finds himself next to Stephen T. Of course, he's there with his camera and says, Steve, can you please photograph Lewis's intermediates every time he comes by? And in doing that, because you've got, you know, you can see on the digital screens of the DSLRs what the state of the tyres are in. So effectively, Paddy says that we could keep Lewis out and go on to win that race quite famously for much longer than perhaps otherwise we would have noticed. And it just happened to be chance that he was next to Stephen. And then for subsequent races, they implemented that as policy. So for the Silverstone race, very famous wet race, Felipe Massa spinning all those times, Hamilton, you know, absolutely racing away from the field. That was part of it. They were using the photographers to keep an eye on Lewis's tyres, probably everyone else's tyres at the same time. So yeah, it's a fascinating little detail. And I actually have to say, very much speaks to Stephen T's character that of all the times I've spoken with him, he's never mentioned it. Like, if that was me, I'd be waving that story. I'd be saying, look, I basically won, helped win these races for Lewis Hamilton in 2008 with my camera. I think that's absolutely fantastic. So yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful detail. And also in a sort of, I don't know, is it depressing or is it just in fact another example of how relentless and how detailed Formula One teams are now that there are these sensors have been developed that means such techniques aren't needed.
Put Steve out of a job. Do you know, I phoned Steve to check that was true and wasn't just a, you know, Paddy Lowe having some sort of head fart, and Steve just said, oh yeah I remember that, yeah, as if he'd sort of just found this fact down the back of a sofa the way you might find a 20p piece with a bit of chewing gum on it. It's like, oh yeah I remember doing that. Yeah, Steve, you played a pivotal role in a great Grand Prix. Just taking pictures, work for McLaren anyway.
Shows you the wonderful life that he's led, clearly. That happened, very good. But yeah, what a man.
Yeah, it's just such a small story in the great history of Steve T.
I thought that was a great little little insight, you know, into exactly to your point, Alex, the obsession that teams have with detail, you know, to come up with the idea of get a photographer, take a picture of the photographs of the tires on each lap. And for listeners, they might be surprised to know that was a relatively new thing back then, because of course digital photography had only just arrived. You couldn't do that in the 1980s or 1990s because they'd have had to have gone off and developed a film, which would have taken rather longer than a lap. So the fact that you could just shoot a photograph lap after lap and then analyze that, and it's all about the data and the information and how you can possibly gather that. I have to say, Cottage, I also think it was an inspired decision when talking about Lewis at Silverstone to go back beyond, you know, before his Formula One career. Because I remember that weekend so vividly. The magazine has picked up on the fact that it was a moment when Lewis really arrived into the consciousness of so many fans and indeed Formula One media with his performance over that weekend. And I think I think I'm right in saying on the first race on the Saturday, he qualified second, I think, beside Adam Carroll. And yeah, of course, Adam subsequently drove for me in A1GP and won the championship in 2009. So, and Adam used to talk about Lewis because of course, obviously he was racing with him at the time in GP2, but also I remember him talking about him in terms of him being such a great racer, because Adam was not only quick, but also he loved a race. He was a good wheel-to-wheel racer, and he really relished that time that he had racing against Lewis in F1. And then I also, you know, without going into this, without giving away the whole story, you know, again, Frederick Vasseur, his recollection of the importance of that weekend from a psychological point of view, what that did, you know, Lewis destroying the competition psychologically, kind of very much destroying Nelson Piquet at that race, just with the way in which he drove it. And I remember Clivio Piccioni talking about the overtake, because I'd gotten to know Clivio's parents, and I remember him, you know, talking about Lewis coming past them. I mean, I think probably regarded it as a slightly bittersweet moment that you're best remembered for the moment when Lewis Hamilton came straight past you in a GP2 race, you know. But but anyway, yeah, fantastic. A fantastic moment in Lewis's career. And as we then see through the other three Grand Prix that are talked about in the piece, it just reminds you, not that we need reminding, about the fact that Lewis has always had fantastic racecraft and this hard charger mentality, which he brought all the way through junior formula and then carried it very successfully into Formula One from the get-go. I know we're going to talk about Yuki Tsunoda a little bit later on in the podcast, but one of the things that, you know, we'll talk about is how long it takes drivers to get up to speed in Formula One and to establish themselves. And yet when you go and you look back at Lewis, he was so ready for Formula One when he came into it, and he didn't need 3 years to get up to speed and to mature and settle down. He was already a fully polished item by the time he got there.
I mean, he was fantastically well prepared, wasn't he, Lewis, at the time? Because he was able to, not just because he was a phenomenal talent and he was coming to, I wouldn't actually call it a peak, he was certainly scaling the heights in GP2 as was, so he didn't need another year there. And he almost gave McLaren no alternative but to place him in Formula One. And yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how some drivers do that and other people don't. You know, we're looking at what's happening around us at the moment. You've got various people in a WEC or IndyCar holding pattern. You've got Teo Pourchaire, who seems to be permanently orbiting the Sauber system without ever gaining admittance. Maybe talk of Oliver Behrmann leapfrogging him in the grand scheme of things. You've got Felipe Drugovich, who won F2 and hasn't managed to parlay that into a drive. Alpine testing Mick Schumacher, who's already kind of proved that the apple's fallen slightly too far from the tree. So yeah, it is tricky. I mean, well, let's turn to Yuki Tsunoda, shall we? Because I suppose, you know, if you've watched F1 long enough, you'll be familiar with the commentator's curse. You know, the TV's David Croft or Murray Walker or whatever, and their expert sidekick points out how well a particular driver is doing. Used to happen more often to Murray Walker because cars would explode more often in those days. And almost the moment the commentator has pointed out how well they're doing, the driver spins off or something terrible happens to them. And lo, we do a deep dive into Yuki Tsunoda, how he's establishing himself as RB's team leader. All of a sudden, he's at the back of the grid again as their upgrade package goes to hell. So, as Alex has been watching this past weekend, has the upgrade package gone to hell? Or is it just our imagination?
Well, I've got a theory about RB, but just on the commentator's curse thing, Codders, you'll remember that you commissioned me to write a feature about Daniel Ricciardo at the start of 2024, about how this was the year that he was going to be anointed to go back to Red Bull Racing, that all he had to do was blow away Yuki Tsunoda. That wasn't going to be that difficult. And Sergio Perez will do as Sergio Perez does and has done, completely underwhelmed. Christian Horner will get his way, and Daniel Ricciardo will be back in the big team. And how utterly wrong that was proved to be. Like, that very much, that probably was an example of the commentator's curse. I mean, we couldn't have known, of course, how the Red Bull management was, that sort of war there was going to blow up. But also, you know, Ricciardo has not performed ultimately. I think we'll come back to that. But yeah, the upgrade on the RB in Barcelona is an interesting one because it's quite a comprehensive package, you know, floor changes, rear wing, things like that, engine cover. The team, what's worrying really is that the team's confused. So their data is showing them that the upgrades actually worked, that fundamentally it produced more downforce and therefore it made the car quicker. But they haven't been able to get it into the balanced sweet spot with the setup changes. It's particularly, you know, things that they were enjoying previously. So that's worrying on one front. It's almost Mercedes-like, those sort of comments, those sort of explanations, that sort of development. But actually, I'm not sure. I think perhaps, you know, it's just, I think the reason why this has got so... it's gone so wide in terms of people saying, oh, RB, panic stations, what's going on? Revert to the old upgrades. Revert back, Goddess, to the old upgrades. But I think it's just the nature of the fact that it was a big package and clearly it hasn't gone quite as well as hoped. But I think it's been forgotten that the RB car's strength is in slower corners or lower speed corners. So it's what they do well. You know, Yuki Tsunoda talks about it quite a lot in the piece. Mexico 2023 is a high downforce circuit. You've got the street tracks, the car has scored most of its points on those sort of non-traditional circuits. And we've rocked up, or F1's rocked up at the first track of the year with high speed turns that really do test ultimate downforce levels through those quicker turns, and suddenly they're not in points contention. So I don't actually think it's that surprising. I think it's more to do with the inherent characteristics of that car than anything else. But what that also is very interesting is there all this fuss about, oh, the RB is just copying the Red Bull, it's going to be 1, 2, 3, 4 for Red Bull. How wide of the mark that was and how quiet things have got on that front. So yeah, odd situation at RB, but perhaps it was more expected than perhaps many people thought, realized. I mean, I could be completely wrong on this, but I just think if you look at what that car is good at, Barcelona is not the track for it. So Silverstone, I would expect, not going to be brilliant either.
Oh well, it's a good thing this is published before Silverstone, so we won't be proved wrong after the fact, before the fact, before we hit the streets. It's always a thing, isn't it, when you do the stately progress of monthly magazine deadlines. You think, well, you know, this is a storyline that's coming about, and by the time you hit the newsstands, the driver that you've thought, well, it might actually do the business, has ceased to do the business. And it is quite interesting, isn't it, that Oleg's picked up in his piece, and also he's very much quizzed Tsunoda about it. I hate that word, quizzed. You know, he obviously didn't say, what is your name, what how many kilograms in a ton, that sort of thing. What time of day did they go to the hospital in squeezes up the junction? He pressed him on 450, Alex, if you're going to Google that.
Of course.
Famously, he actually asked him about that Mexican Grand Prix where Tsunoda basically screwed his own race because he was so obsessed with trying to beat Ricciardo and prove that he was the better driver. And actually, he's learned from that, and the team feel that he's learned from that. And importantly, he's allying this ability to be quick with being more consistent, and that is really, really valuable when you look at the slightly shoddy job that Sergio Perez is doing in the second Red Bull of being sometimes quick and then sometimes binning it.
Yeah, I think with Tsunoda, what really came across really well in the piece is actually that if you speak to him away from, you know, the awful scrums in the pen, as we're told to call it, after qualifying in the race for the written media, and away from the big group sessions, is that, you know, you can really get some amazing stories out of him. Like, you know, the idea that, that what he says about, you know, after that Mexico contact with Oscar Piastri that spun him around, was that he just went and locked himself in his hotel room and was just absolutely sort of destroyed. What, you know, what have I done sort of thing? And that the really interesting detail that's come out there. But also, you know, the fact that he's even talking about this, like it's a really honest piece about how, like, he didn't need to do that. He just, you know, the chatter was, as we then published in GP Racing, was all about Ricciardo, and Tsunoda was like, no, okay, he was quick in qualifying, I've had an engine penalty, I'm coming back here and I'm going to pass him, and I'm going to show you that I am just as good. And one, I love that confidence, but then obviously he messed it up, and it that is that sort of thing that Red Bull really doesn't like. There is this understanding that particularly Helmut Marko just doesn't rate Tsunoda. Like Perez has been so bad these last few years. Red Bull isn't blind to that. And I think the suggestion is that if Sergio Perez had actually managed to take Max Verstappen out at the start of the Miami Grand Prix, no more contracts for you, Sergio, is the sort of suggestion. But it doesn't have any better options other than, you know, does it want to bring Carlos Sainz in and destabilize things and bring back a driver that rejected them, Fernando Alonso, all the trouble that you're going to potentially get by doing that. And the fact that Tsunoda isn't being promoted just shows you still that Red Bull itself isn't sold on him. And there's the piece brings this out, I think, really well, and a great piece from Oleg, is the fact that Tsunoda, perhaps more than any other driver, is so much, and it's interesting parallels with Perez, is so much about confidence. It's taken him years to get over the start of sort of the midpoint in 2021 when he was crashing a lot. Things weren't going well. He thought it was a chassis problem. AlphaTauri RB couldn't find one. They do change the chassis. He comes back and he's brilliant. Or sorry, much improved. And then it snowballed from there. And he now has got to the point where he is doing very, very well. If he were to go to Red Bull and be consistently beaten by Max Verstappen, as Sergio Perez is, as all of his teammates have been, that chunk of time, it's usually on average 0.3, often it's more. I think that would be Tsunoda's confidence gone. And I don't think Red Bull is willing to risk that. That's how it seems.
Okay. Mark, in your column, you talk about Red Bull. It's a subject you've sort of orbited around quite often, of, you know, Dietrich Mateschitz and the values that he instilled in that team. I find myself wondering what on earth is going on with RB in terms of its place in the Red Bull universe. It kind of feels as if the current regime don't know what to do with it in the way that Mateschitz knew what he wanted from it. Do you think that's fair to say?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's the case or not, because, I mean, from the limited amount of information that I know, essentially, RB is, if you like, the team that the Austrian headquarters of Red Bull has a degree of control over, whereas Red Bull Racing, as we know it, is very much under the influence of the Thai shareholders, which are, of course, very closely aligned with Christian Horner. So the two teams, to some extent, represent two factions. Factions is probably too strong a word. Two sides to the Red Bull, you know, Formula One philosophy, their strategy, and also the influence that they have from the shareholder group. So I think, you know, yes, they are sister teams, but again, this also then goes back to what you were saying, Alex, about, you know, all the stories around the fact that RB would essentially be running a mirror image of the RB20 and, you know, finishing third and fourth all the time. And it's not, you know, they're very distinct entities with distinct strategies and influences and reporting lines, and of course also their commercial operations are very different. And you think about that Visa, you know, Cash App deal, massive sponsorship deal that came in, and it's been very cleverly placed by, you know, Red Bull with the RB team, and it's given, you know, Visa, Cash App exactly what they wanted from a title sponsorship and, you know, prominent branding in Formula One. So I see them as much more distinct operations, and they're not really separated by a Chinese wall. You know, it's a very definite wall between the two. There is obviously a degree of crossover at the marketing and technical levels. There's no doubt about that. I think what's interesting, again, going back to something, Alex, that you just finished on, is that, you know, I think Red Bull are, and this is the overall Red Bull group, are sensible enough to know that Tsunoda's better off being the number one driver at RB than the number two driver at Red Bull Racing, for precisely the reasons that number two drivers consistently find out it can be incredibly destructive to your mental state, and it's a tough place to be. And when I saw Perez's contract renewed, I thought to myself, well, actually, this is going to get criticized by lots of people. The fans are going to criticize it. The media will criticize it. Actually, what you're seeing there is, in a year where there has been a lot of turmoil at Red Bull Racing, a lot of there have been a lot of lot of things going on there. This felt like a very easy decision to make. We'll just keep the driver lineup the same. We'll just continue with what we've got. What we've got may not be perfect from the point of view. You know, we're not getting 1-2 finishes. Sergio's not qualifying in the front row beside Max. But actually, Max is doing a fantastic job. And let's not interfere with that balance. That balance is working. You know, Max is very definitely, you know, leading the charge. And even though there's some weaknesses that come with effectively having one hand tied behind your back in every race, because Sergio's just not there in a position to support Max, Max is able to carry it. You know, he's done a brilliant job, and I don't think they want to destabilize that. And then going back to Yuki and this feature, a couple of points that I will just echo what you've just said to Alex, really. You know, so much of this story is about a young driver who's come in with, you know, prodigious talent. He's come up through the Honda Dream program. He's done, you know, he's clearly quick. But when he came into Formula One, there weren't just rough edges. I mean, the guy was totally unprepared for Formula One in respect of the environment and the pressures that come with that. So whilst he may well have been schooled by Honda and supported by Honda very well as a driver of a car, he was completely underprepared for everything that came with that. And the immaturity came out, you know, in bucketfuls, you know, all those rants on the radio and the emotion and all that. I mean, it was just unprofessional, but it was unprofessional because he didn't know any better. He now knows a lot better. And I thought that what's great about the feature is the honesty that comes through from him. You know, he's very reflective. He's still a young guy, but he's still saying, he's now saying, looking back, he wouldn't do things the way he did them back then. He learned a lot. I love Jody Eggington's, you know, contribution, because he points out that push-pull that exists between competitive drivers. When you have someone like Pierre Gasly pushing Yuki kind of learning how much he learned from being teammate to Pierre. And now he's, you know, established himself as team leader. I mean, as we're recording this podcast, he's got 19 points to Daniel Ricciardo's 9. So he's got over double Daniel's points. And, you know, Yuki is, he's just becoming that polished item. And you actually feel that there's more to come. I mean, has that feeling about it. You know, he's still not quite there. There's more development to come from Yuki, which is a very exciting prospect. So actually being team leader at RB is quite a nice spot for him to be in. And it's going to be really interesting to see what happens over the next 18 months, 2 years, if he continues to cement that role within the team. And also then, of course, what happens with the driver that's sitting alongside him. We know we have a young Liam Lawson who's, you know, still desperately keen to get a chance, get a crack at the Ricciardo drive if that opportunity were to become available. So it's an interesting one, but fundamentally it's a great feature about a driver and his trajectory into Formula One, and then all that he has learned since he came into it. And and he's done that. He's done the one thing that Helmut Marko will really appreciate, which is he has generally learned from his mistakes and become faster and faster over time. And that's what you want. You want a trajectory that looks good.
Certainly more fun for us and for fans to be writing about, hearing about drivers who are improving and are on a trajectory towards getting better and building towards something, than drivers who, shall we say, have stuck around for a little too long, mentioning no names, Kimi Raikkonen, and having offended half the F1 fandom. It's time for us to bring this podcast to a close for another month. Guys, thank you. Mark, you're about to stand up in front of thousands of people and lead them all in some sort of rampant spend on Formula One. Good luck with that.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I'm going to enjoy myself this afternoon because we're talking about, you know, what it takes to build a competitive team. So I will be explaining to them that in Alpine's, that we've just spent this podcast talking about, that in Alpine's mind, it involves bringing back a 74-year-old who we thought had long since disappeared. There you go. Different way of going about it.
And Alex, you'll be able to enjoy the sunshine of East London.
I certainly shall. It's looking irritatingly cloudy at the moment. Yeah. But yeah, just recharge the batteries after the Spanish Grand Prix. I'm supporting our coverage on Autosport remotely for the Austrian Grand Prix, then heading off to Switzerland. But Codders, if you don't mind, can I just share something, seeing as it came up naturally? He was brought up in conversation, Dietrich Mateschitz. I learned this the other day. Other people may be aware of this already. It is out there. It's a matter of public record. But before he passed, he was getting Red Bull Advanced Technologies to build him a submarine that he could use to navigate the waters around his private island. And I just thought, of course that's what he was doing. I just thought that was fantastic. I interviewed Adrian Newey the other day about his RB17 hypercar project, and I said, that's still happening. You're like, oh yeah, we're still working on it.
But at least he wasn't planning on going to see the Titanic. Well, anyway, thank you, Alex. I will see you in person at Silverstone next week. And thanks also to our listener. If you don't yet subscribe to GP Racing, head to gpracing.com, where print and digital and Autosport Plus packages start at 3 issues for £3. If you prefer to make use of retail establishments, they still exist. Make sure that journey isn't wasted. Visit seymour.co.uk, type your postcode into the store finder to locate your nearest stockist. And that is Seymour, spelled as in Charles Gurney Seymour, second son of the Earl of Bridgewater in the novel First Among Equals by Geoffrey Archer. No, I haven't read it either. Great to have around in case we run out of bog roll if there's a nuclear war or something. The producer was Dre Harrison. Thank you for listening. We'll speak to you again next month.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.